Chapter 7 Black Lives Matter. After Donald Trump was sworn into office, Black Lives Matter, BLM, co-founder Patrice Cullors was interviewed in the Los Angeles Times. In August 2017, she was asked if BLM would be open to a conversation with the president. She responded, "We wouldn't, as a movement, take a seat at the table with Trump, because we wouldn't have done that with Hitler. Trump is literally the epitome of evil, all the evils of this country, be it racism, capitalism, sexism, homophobia." In her own words, one of the founders of BLM demonstrates how closely the organization's ideology aligns with Antifa. Central to both is the goal of abolishing law enforcement, American jurisprudence, national borders, and free markets in the name of anti-racism and anti-fascism. BLM also seeks to undermine free speech. In October 2017, students affiliated with BLM at the College of William and Mary in Virginia prevented the executive director of the Virginia chapter of the ACLU from speaking. Live streaming the shutdown on a student BLM page, students shouted, "The revolution will not uphold the Constitution," and "Liberalism is white supremacy." They were angry the ACLU had given a principled First Amendment defense of far-right ideologues. Earlier that year, Cullors was interviewed by Katie Tour on MSNBC, where she stated, "Hate speech, which is what we're seeing coming out of white nationalist groups, is not protected under the First Amendment rights." Foundation of Lies. On August 9th, 2014, an 18-year-old black male named Michael Brown committed a strong-arm robbery at a neighborhood convenience store in Ferguson, a suburb of St. Louis, Missouri. Shortly after, police officer Darren Wilson, who is white, questioned Brown. Brown matched the description of the robbery suspect reported to police. According to Wilson, Brown assaulted him during the questioning and attempted to grab his pistol, causing it to fire inside the car. Wilson says he chased after Brown, who turned around and charged at him. Wilson fired upon the 6'4" man, who died at the scene. The killing of Brown set off days of rioting and looting in Ferguson, as well as other protests across the United States. With the aid of social media and wall-to-wall broadcast coverage featuring rumors that Brown had surrendered with his hands up and was executed, the BLM narrative was born. From coast to coast, "hands up, don't shoot" became the mantra that drove tens of thousands to the street to protest or riot against what they say is institutional racism in policing and the American legal system. In November 2014, a St. Louis County grand jury declined to bring criminal charges against Wilson, finding that he was justified in the shooting. In the hours after the announcement of the decision, more rioting, fires, and looting occurred in St. Louis County. Protests broke out across the country in 170 cities. The evidence that emerged in the hearing that corroborated Wilson's account didn't matter. Many pinned their hopes on President Barack Obama's Department of Justice, DOJ, to prosecute Wilson. Eric Holder, the left-wing attorney general, made statements openly sympathetic to Brown and BLM. But to the disappointment of many, the report produced by the DOJ in 2015 further exonerated Wilson. How? Physical evidence, ballistics, DNA, and vetted witness statements. "Hands up, don't shoot" was a myth perpetuated by Brown's friend Dorian Johnson, who was found to be unreliable by investigators. Other witnesses who claimed they saw Brown surrender admitted they had just repeated rumors they heard from the media or others. That so few Americans are aware of the true story behind the death that made BLM a household name and top political issue demonstrates the power of storytelling. It wasn't just Brown who benefited from false narratives, but also other deceased or injured figures posthumously adopted as martyr figures in BLM, for example, Trayvon Martin and Sandra Bland. The most devastating consequences of BLM is that it provided the outlet for radical Marxist views to enter mainstream American media, politics, and society under the guise of racial justice. Marxist ideology. BLM is usually presented as an anti-racist uprising and movement focused on countering anti-black police brutality and systemic racism. This effective branding strategy in the name has masked BLM's true radical ideology. The slogan is very difficult for anyone to disagree with, says Carol Swain, a retired political scientist who taught at Vanderbilt University. Swain, who is black, is a scholar of American politics and law. She has spoken critically about BLM and its laundering of radical Marxist ideas into the mainstream. For her outspokenness, she was protested by students at Vanderbilt and subjected to demands she be fired. Swain ended up taking early retirement from Vanderbilt in August 2017. She tells her detractors and critics to simply read the material BLM and its leaders have published to see the truth. Indeed, on-record statements and writings made by the group's three founders, Alicia Garza, Patrice Cullors, and Opel Tometi, demonstrate their agenda to mainstream hatred of law enforcement, capitalism, free speech, and the United States itself. If this sounds familiar, it is because these are also core ideological components of Antifa, with one notable exception being that BLM is not necessarily opposed to the concept of a nation-state if they are at the helm. BLM was founded in 2013, shortly after George Zimmerman was acquitted in the shooting death of black teen Trayvon Martin in Florida. Zimmerman, who is Latino, was found by a jury to be defending himself from Martin, who was beating him on the ground. Since its founding, BLM's leaders have not hidden its radical Marxist orientation. BLM draws from the legacy of the militant Black Power movement of the 1960s and 1970s, seen in figures it reveres like convicted cop killer and fugitive Assata Shakur, formerly known as Joanne Byron. In July 2015, at the Blog Her Media Conference in New York, two of the three BLM co-founders led the conference in reciting part of a letter authored by Shakur. "It is our duty to fight for our freedom. It is our duty to win. We must love each other and support each other. We have nothing to lose but our chains." This chant is part of a manifesto written by Shakur in 1973 while she was in prison for being an accomplice in the murder of New Jersey State Trooper Werner Forster. In the letter, she calls herself a black revolutionary who has declared war on the rich and all the mindless, heartless robots who protect them and their property. The line about losing chains is lifted directly out of the Communist Manifesto. At protests, Shakur is honored through the recitation of this chant as well as through clothing worn by BLM supporters. That Shakur is treated as such a revered figure in BLM is no small detail. Shakur was a member of the far-left violent extremist group Black Liberation Army, BLA. The BLA declared war on the United States and carried out a series of bombings, robberies, and cop killings in the 1970s. Its actions mirrored those of the Baader-Meinhof gang. Shakur escaped prison in 1979 with the help of BLA members who took correctional officers hostage. She later fled to Cuba, where she was granted asylum and treated as a hero by the communist Fidel Castro regime. She is believed to be there to this day. BLM's adoration of communism is not just indirect through its honouring of Shakur. An essay authored by the group on its official Medium blog, titled Lessons from Fidel, Black Lives Matter and the Transition of El Comandante, mourned the death of the communist despot in 2016. As a black network committed to transformation, we are particularly grateful to Fidel for holding Mama Assata Shakur, who continues to inspire us, the essay reads. We are thankful that he provided a home for Brother Michael Finney, Ralph Goodwin and Charles Hill, asylum to Brother Huey P. Newton, and sanctuary for so many other black revolutionaries who were being persecuted by the American government during the Black Power era. Finney, Goodwin, and Hill were members of the Republic of New Africa, a militant Marxist group that sought to create a black ethno-state in the American South. They killed a New Mexico state trooper named Robert Rosenblum in 1971, and hijacked an airplane at Albuquerque International Airport. Africa was their preferred destination, but there wasn't enough fuel, so they instead flew to Cuba, where they were given asylum. Huey Newton was a co-founder of the Black Panther Party and a convict with a violent history. He was involved in the shooting-related death of an Oakland police officer in 1968 and was accused of shooting a teen sex worker in 1974. BLM is also a member of the Movement for Black Lives, M4BL, a collective of radical left organizations that share the BLM agenda of overturning capitalism and destabilizing the United States. On its now-deleted page listing various demands, the M4BL had stated, "The interlinked systems of white supremacy, imperialism, capitalism, and patriarchy shape the violence we face. As oppressed people living in the US, the belly of global empire, we are in a critical position to build the necessary connections for a global liberation movement. Until we are able to overturn US imperialism, capitalism, and white supremacy, our brothers and sisters around the world will continue to live in chains." The usage of chains in this context is again a reference to classic communist literature. Additionally, accusations of American imperialism hearken explicitly to the Cold War era propaganda of the Soviet Union, which viewed US imperialism not necessarily as an expansion of territory, but the spreading of liberal politics, capitalism, and culture. The anti-capitalism agenda of BLM naturally filters down to its local chapters. Whenever there have been BLM riots, looting follows. During the summer of rioting in 2020, mass looting broke out in downtown Chicago in August, after false rumors spread on social media that Chicago police had shot and killed a black child. Among the thousands of people who amplified the lie, the Chicago chapter of BLM. "If your rules include you shooting our youth, you can't expect people to play by your rules," tweeted BLM Chicago in the middle of the looting spree on Michigan Avenue. Videos live-streamed from the area showed police completely overwhelmed as thousands of looters ransacked luxury stores, including Gucci, Louis Vuitton, Apple, and Tesla. Some rioters even used a stolen car to smash through storefronts. By the end of the night, more than a dozen officers were injured, and around 100 people were arrested. Chicago police and the city's mayor confirmed that rumors of a police-involved killing of a child were false. Police say 20-year-old convicted felon Latrell Allen was armed with a handgun at a park where children were playing. When police responded, he allegedly took off running and fired at police. The police shot back and injured, but did not kill him. Allen's handgun, retrieved at the scene, matches photographs of him posing with a gun posted on his own social media. After the night's mass looting in Chicago, The response from BLM Chicago was to hold a protest in support of looters who were arrested at the scene. They held a rally outside the South Loop police station and displayed a banner that read in all caps, "Loot Back." In addition, the group released a statement saying that downtown businesses were the ones that had looted from black communities. Ariel Atkins, a local BLM organizer, told NBC Chicago, "I don't care if someone decides to loot a Gucci or a Macy's or a Nike store, because that makes sure that person eats." BLM's contempt for property rights is demonstrated over and over in the actions and thoughts of leaders in the group. But those still unconvinced of BLM's greater revolutionary Marxist agenda need only look to the words of Alicia Garza, Opal Tometi, and Patrice Cullors. "How do we stop black-on-black crime?" asked Garza in a January 2015 tweet. "First stop, by understanding the root. It's not black pathology, it's capitalism." In July 2016, she followed up on the subject by tweeting, "White supremacy and capitalism are the underlying causes of state-sanctioned police-orchestrated violence." Opal Tometi echoed similar sentiments. In August 2015, she wrote on Twitter, "I'm anti-capitalism and I'm for the dismantling of a two-party system that is doing nothing for us." In July 2016, she tweeted, "I share three core challenges we face. One, global capitalism. Two, white supremacy. Three, suppressing dissent, access to democracy." The third BLM co-founder, Patrice Cullors, has been the most transparent and outspoken in her radical Marxist views. The 36-year-old was trained and mentored by Eric Mann, a former leader of the Weather Underground organization, a far-left domestic terrorist group active in the 1960s and 1970s. Mann was convicted in 1969 in an incident where live rounds were fired into the Cambridge Police Headquarters in Massachusetts. He served 2 years in prison. In April 2019, Cullors, who is an associate professor in the Social Justice and Community Organizing Master's Degree Program at Prescott College in Arizona, penned an article for the Harvard Law Review. "Our task is not only to abolish prisons, policing, and militarization, which are wielded in the name of public safety and national security," she wrote. "We must also demand reparations and incorporate reparative justice into our vision for society and community building in the 21st century." Cullors goes on to describe the United States as "the most extensive purveyor of human rights atrocities at home and abroad." She called for no less than the dismantling of the United States. "Abolition means no borders. Abolition means no border patrol. Abolition means no immigration and customs enforcement." And if that's not convincing enough of BLM's Marxist extremism, a resurfaced video of a 2015 interview featuring Cullors went viral in June 2020. "The first thing, I think, is that we actually do have an ideological frame. Myself and Alicia Garza in particular are trained organizers," she said in an interview with Jared Ball of the Real News Network. "We are trained Marxists. We are super versed on sort of ideological theories, and I think that what we really tried to do is build a movement that could be utilized by many, many black folk." Retired Professor Carol Swain, who called out BLM for its radicalism years ago, isn't surprised by the video. "We see them making progress because you see how easily and quickly police have become the enemy, as opposed to people who are trying to harm others." She points to the deadly effect on black American communities when law enforcement pull back from policing and are reluctant to arrest suspects out of fear. Observers have called this documented and studied phenomenon the Ferguson effect. A 2016 study released by the U.S. Department of Justice and conducted by Richard Rosenfeld, a University of Missouri St. Louis criminologist, found murder spiking in urban areas after the riots in Ferguson, Missouri. Convergence. James Lindsay, co-author of Cynical Theories, How Activist Scholarship Made Everything About Race, Gender, and Identity, and Why This Harms Everybody, pinpoints BLM as the vector that allowed social justice activism on campuses to metastasize into a violent, virulent movement in the rest of American society. Black Lives Matter was enormously visible, Lindsay says. It was everywhere and presented as a matter of life and death. Indeed, the urgency surrounding BLM pressured sympathetic liberals to tolerate and even excuse even the most illiberal excesses of the movement. From street protesters carrying signs and chanting slogans urging for police to be killed, to even instances of mass murder, BLM's legitimacy was protected by liberals. And while the murder of Heather Heyer at Charlottesville continues to be a rallying cry for the left, few seem to remember that in July 2016, a 25-year-old black man killed five police officers with a sniper rifle at a BLM protest in Dallas. According to the Dallas police chief, the shooter, Micah Xavier Johnson, verbalized a grievance related to BLM and said he wanted to kill white people, particularly white police officers. A failed negotiation resulted in police sending in a bomb attached to a robot to kill Johnson. 10 days later, 29-year-old black separatist Gavin Eugene Long, who went by Cosmo Osar Setipenra, shot six police officers, killing three, in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. He left behind a letter expressing grievances against the police, similar to BLM's ideology. Despite the BLM-inspired violence in 2016 and riots in 2020, the group and movement are still protected by the mainstream media. There is absolutely zero evidence that Black Lives Matter has ever pushed for anything violent to happen to police, said MSNBC host Joy Reid in October 2020. Her comment echoed the denial of Antifa violence repeated throughout the year by journalists. Through BLM, Antifa ideologues saw an opportunity to be mainstreamed. Taking advantage of the urgency and panic, Antifa were able to say that their militant actions were needed to address white supremacy and fascism. As the Republican Party base began to consolidate behind candidate Trump in 2016, BLM took to the streets to protest. It was during this time that an informal alliance developed between BLM and Antifa. Trained in fighting and ready for battle, Antifa militants acted as volunteer security at BLM-style protests. In July 2016, in downtown Portland, at a BLM protest organized by Don't Shoot Portland, I witnessed this relationship developing in real time. White people in Antifa were asked by an organizer to stand on the edges of the rally in order to physically shield people of color in case a white supremacist carried out an attack. The speeches that day were extreme. "You pull your pistol out and you fucking bust them, the cops," said one speaker at the center of Pioneer Courthouse Square. "At the end of the day, it's going to be you against them." The crowd clapped and cheered in response. Another speaker, a young woman, railed against the capitalist system. Halfway into the protest, a group of Antifa Black Bloc militants pushed Michael Strickland, a conservative videographer, out of the public rally. They pursued him with sticks. Strickland brandished a legal handgun in response and told the mob to get back before holstering the weapon. He was promptly arrested by police and ultimately convicted on numerous felonies for unlawful use of a firearm. Those who chased and threatened to hurt him that day faced no consequences. As Antifa in Portland solidified their relationship with BLM, the convergence was also witnessed at the national level. Jeffrey Sean King, better known as Sean King, a celebrity left-wing activist, became BLM's most powerful social media influencer. With over 1 million followers on Twitter, King has made videos, allegations, and stories go viral, usually capturing the attention of powerful politicians. But his overzealous sharing of unverified content has also blown up in his face. On more than one occasion, King amplified an accusation that turned out to be untrue, misattributed, or a complete hoax. For example, in late 2018, King set off a media and political frenzy when he repeated a Houston family's claim that a white male with blue eyes had shot and killed 7-year-old Jasmine Barnes. King helped raise over $100,000 as a bounty and even shared the photo of a possible suspect. But he was entirely wrong. Police arrested 2 suspects, both of whom are black. The family of the man falsely blamed by King for killing Jasmine received violent death threats. But despite King's reckless social media activism, he still has significant influence and is sought after by journalists as a voice for BLM. Following the BLM-Antifa convergence, King leveraged his huge following to promote Antifa and present them as true first responders. In August 2017, he tweeted, "I support Antifa. In fact, I'm grateful for them. Several people told me Antifa activists saved their lives in Charlottesville." In the same thread, he continued, "I support the communists and socialists standing against Trump and against bigotry and white supremacy." In March 2018, he wrote on Twitter, "I've said it before and I will say it again. I'm thankful for all of the hashtag Antifa counter-protesters standing against bigotry from coast to coast. You don't get the love you deserve." King's support for Antifa's direct action veered into supporting terrorism. 2 days after Antifa militant Willem van Spronson launched the armed attack on a Tacoma, Washington ICE facility in July 2019, King called the man a martyr. Sharing van Spronson's manifesto on Twitter, King said the text was a beautiful, painful, devastating letter. Sometimes the BLM-Antifa relationship is more explicit at the organizational level. In September 2017, the official verified Washington, D.C. chapter of BLM promoted an Antifa gathering on its Twitter page. "Antifa to meet up at 6 p.m. at Franklin Square to protest fascists coming into the city." Then, in July 2019, the same BLM chapter defended Antifa after the violent rioting in Portland where I was beaten. "Stop spreading the dangerous false right-wing narrative about Portland Antifa and Antifa in general," the account tweeted, providing a link to Antifa blog site It's Going Down. Though BLM has some differing goals from Antifa, for example, the more explicit promotion of communism rather than anarchist communism, both ideologies now cross-pollinate and influence one another to the point that they are linked entities. In Portland and Seattle, they are one and the same, with the same people showing up to each other's events. Their convergence has been immensely mutually beneficial. Antifa get mainstream legitimacy on the back of American racial divisions, while BLM gets a volunteer militia at helm.